listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of What Lies Beneath by Julian Sancton. The search began in the spring of 2015 aboard the aging Colombian research vessel Arc Malpelo. Day after day, the Woods Hole crew released the Remus 6000, a torpedo-shaped autonomous underwater vehicle, AUV, mounted with a side-scan sonar, programming it to travel back and forth over a given area of the seafloor in a pattern called mowing the lawn. Then, Dooley and Kozak would peruse the sonar data for any anomalies. After several weeks, they had found nothing. The search was paused until the end of the year because Woods Hole had another job. Though he tried not to show it, Dooley was worried. Garces, the Minister of Culture, began to doubt whether Dooley actually had any idea where the wreck was. "If I don't find it, I'll cut my head off," Dooley told her, dragging a finger across his throat. The gesture became a running joke. The time and money hadn't been wasted, however. In a systematic search, it's crucial to know where something isn't. When the survey resumed that November, it took just a week for the AUV to pick up a promising object on the seabed, more than 600 meters deep. "Now, I've been analyzing sonar data for 45 years," said Kozak, "and when I saw that signature, I knew that it was almost certainly the remains of an old wreck." That same day, November 26th, Dooley ordered a higher resolution scan of the area. The images the AUV recorded were electrifying. Dooley saw jars, bottles, and other artifacts that appeared to date from the turn of the 18th century. But what jumped out at him first was the presence of bronze cannons with two dolphin-shaped loops on the barrel and another one at the breech. A rare design that the archaeologist was specifically looking for. Dooley knew that he had found the San Jose. When he saw Garces next, he slashed a finger across his throat and smiled. Many colonial-era shipwrecks no longer look like ships. Wooden hulls often smashed against reefs during hurricanes, their fragments dispersed by currents, swells, and storms over hundreds of years. Whatever is left is typically covered in sand and coral. Mack's photographs of the San Jose, by contrast, reveal a vessel in a remarkable state of preservation. It is nestled into the mud at a depth where currents exert little force. The mast and rigging are long gone, but the contours of its hull are easy to follow. 22 bronze cannons are scattered on and around the deck, like pickup sticks, alongside ceramic jars, cooking pots, enema syringes, Dutch gin bottles, and hundreds of Chinese porcelain cups, vestiges of a complex globalized society. And after 3 centuries in seawater, pretty much all that glitters is gold. A surprising amount of it is visible in the photos, concentrated at the stern of the ship, in the form of coins and finger-sized bars, hinting at the untold riches buried below. To Dooley, the site also tells a story of horrific violence. The blanket of mud dips steeply toward the front of the galleon, indicating that the entire bow of the ship had broken off. Likely as the result of an explosion in the powder magazine. Once that happened, the galleon was no more seaworthy than a sideways bucket. Water would have quickly filled what was left of the hold, and the San Jose would have sunk before most men could abandon ship. The only survivors would have been those high up in the rigging. When Jack Harbiston heard that Dooley had found the San Jose, he immediately suspected foul play. In the early 2000s, Dooley had worked on a project for another salvage company Harbiston ran, Iota Partners, overseeing the excavation of a colonial Spanish shipwreck in the Pacific Islands. When we were routinely cleaning out the computers at the end of the work season, said Harbiston, I found on his computer notes about the San Jose. Harbiston believes Dooley had access to Sea Search Armada's computers while on location and could have stolen the coordinates of the San Jose. Dooley has called the accusation absurd and irresponsible. At his condo, he rolls out a large map of the Colombian coastline on the dining room table. He points to a red dot labeled SJ, where Mac found the San Jose, then puts a finger on the location reported by Glacamara in 1982, several miles away. When he caught me trying to eyeball Mac's coordinates, still a state secret, he quickly rolled the map back up. Okay, that's enough. There's ample evidence that Glacamara and Mac located different objects. The anomaly that the submarine Auguste Piccard investigated in 1981 lay at a depth of about 200 meters on hilly terrain, while Mac reported that the wreck of the San Jose was found on a flat expanse of mud and silt, some 600 meters deep. Glacamara claims to have spotted several wood piles and at least one cannon, so it is quite possible the team found debris from the Battle of 1708, perhaps even from the San Jose, though that has never been established. Whether the company found the galleon itself is less certain. Harbiston says a broad margin of error should be applied to Glacamara's coordinates, since GPS wasn't widely available in the early 80s. And the radio navigation system the company used was far less accurate. In 1994, seeking to verify those coordinates, the Colombian government hired the American explorer and treasure hunter Tommy Thompson to investigate the spot and surrounding areas. He found nothing. There's not the slightest possibility the galleon is there, Thompson said at the time. Sea Search Armada argues that Thompson is far from a credible source. He has spent the last 6 years in a federal prison in Michigan for refusing to divulge the whereabouts of gold coins he salvaged from the SS Central America, worth an estimated $2 million to $5 million. So what, then, was the ship-like object picked up by the Picard's side-scan sonar? Since we now know that the bow of the San Jose broke off, could that section of the ship be buried beneath the coral? Rodrigo Pacheco Ruiz, a marine archaeologist at the University of Southampton, who has closely followed the San Jose affair, is doubtful. If this was a shipwreck and not a natural rocky outcrop, I would say that it could be more a metal-hulled ship, he told me in an email after analyzing the sonar image. Harbiston believes there is an international plot to rob Sea Search Armada of its right to the galleon's treasure. This scheme to steal at least SSA's share of the San Jose had to involve political figures in Colombia, the U.S., and Great Britain, he wrote in an email. This notion of a nefarious conspiracy to abscond with the riches and cultural heritage of the San Jose is echoed in the reporting of Spanish investigative journalist Jesus Garcia Calero, who has covered the saga for the newspaper ABC. He has traced elements of Mac's corporate structure to the Cayman Islands and alleges that some of the people affiliated with Mac have been involved in the disreputable kind of treasure hunting. No representative for Mac was available for comment because, according to Dooley, the company has suspended its operations as the originator continues to negotiate with the Colombian government. I don't work now for Mac, nor does anybody else, Dooley told me. Calero has also repeated the rumor, now gospel among critics of the Santos administration's deal with Mac, that one of the masterminds of this supposed conspiracy is former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. A close friend of Santos, who has been scrutinized for his lucrative consulting work in Colombia, among other countries. Calero has offered no concrete evidence to support the imputation, which a spokesperson for Blair vociferously denied. We have no knowledge of, nor had any involvement with, the deal you refer to. To suggest otherwise is a pure fabrication based on ill-informed gossip and wild speculation. One well-connected San Jose specialist refused to discuss the politics of it on the record. Just do a quick read on Jorge Enrique Pisano and his son Alejandro, he wrote to me. That's the way things work here in Colombia. I looked up the case. Pisano was a whistleblower in a far-reaching corruption investigation into a government deal with Odebrecht, the Brazilian construction giant. Pisano was found dead of a heart attack in 2018. 3 days later, his son Alejandro drank from a bottle of water he found on his father's desk and died of poisoning. Dooley tells me a couple people insinuated that they could help him move his project along in exchange for a kickback, but that he never got into that. He had managed to entice Santos personally, so no intermediary was needed. The secrecy surrounding the project has only fueled suspicion. Normally, between archaeologists, we share our stuff, and we talk about it, said Pacheco Ruiz, the Southampton archaeologist, but these guys don't share anything. Pacheco Ruiz has analyzed the few images of the site that Mac has released publicly and admits they are of very high quality. But he has pointed out what he considers to be troubling discrepancies between photos taken in 2015 and those from 2016. Slight but noticeable changes in the topography, the arrangement of shells, the mounds of silt and mud. At a depth of 600 meters, such changes are likely not due to the current, which is almost non-existent. Pacheco Ruiz is careful not to allege any specific wrongdoing by the Mac team. What I can say is the site is not the same, he tells me. His caution hasn't prevented critics from concluding that Mac has already tampered with the site and perhaps taken objects, which would violate the firm's agreement with the government. Dooley asserts that no artifact has been touched, and attributes changes at the site to natural phenomena. Our wreck lies in an area that is almost flat, composed 95% of silt and clay like mud, he wrote in an email. Therefore, once our wreck arrived, it created like an oasis in the desert, like a small reef, with plenty of wood, hiding and protecting places, holes, etc. Therefore, it was invaded by many marine organisms. The most likely culprits, he says, are larger fish, who flap their fins to move sand around in search of food. The true value of the treasure is impossible to know. The coins are worth whatever collectors are willing to pay for them. It is a legendary ship, because its treasure is estimated to be worth billions. And the treasure is estimated to be worth billions because it comes from a legendary ship. But it is not exempt from the laws of supply and demand. A single rare silver real or gold escudo from the San Jose might sell for hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars at auction. Yet if all 7 million to 12 million pesos were to hit the market at once, the price of the coins would quickly approach the meltdown value of the gold and silver. In 2020, Colombian Vice President Marta Lucia Ramirez, serving under President Ivan Duque, declared all the contents of the San Jose to be objects of cultural interest. What that means in practical terms is that nobody, neither Mac nor C-Search Armada nor another contractor, can take anything from the Galleon San Jose, said Camilo Gomez of the National Agency for the Legal Defense of the State. But the resolution has only led to more uncertainty. A relatively poor country, Colombia has lately been shaken by unending protest, sparked by a revolt over taxes. The government may thus find it politically unsound to fund an ambitious deepwater excavation, likely costing more than the entire annual budget of the Ministry of Culture, with public money, let alone a new museum. Dooley argues that the measure, while well-intentioned, is self-defeating. By outlawing the sale of objects, of which there are many nearly identical specimens, the government will be saddled with the cost of conserving more artifacts than any museum can possibly display. What are you going to do with 1,000,000 coins? He asked. Some have suggested that, since the San Jose is part of our global cultural patrimony, the excavation and conservation should be an international collaboration. But Spain, the country with the strongest historical ties to the Galleon, has shown little interest in paying for a project that will redound to the glory of Colombia. So why would the United States, France, or Norway be more inclined? Gomez says negotiations with the originator are still ongoing, but Dooley doesn't believe any progress will be made until after the next president takes office in August. Faced with the certainty of a judicial free-for-all, the second the first ingot of gold reaches the surface, the next government may well decide to leave the San Jose on the ocean floor. For many archaeologists, that's just as well. The best would be to leave the Galleon where it is, said Juan Guillermo Martin, a professor of archaeology at Colombia's Universidad del Norte, and one of the most outspoken critics of the Santos Mac project. It's been there 300 years, well conserved, and can surely last for centuries more until we acquire the technology, the experience, and the resources to do a suitable job. Gary Kozak, the maritime surveyor who helped Dooley find the San Jose, begs to differ. Archaeologists, for the longest time, have promoted this inaccurate philosophy that leaving something in the ocean is the best preservation, he said, and that's so much bullcrap. Because the ocean is a destructive environment, and everything that is in it is degrading and will disintegrate and go into the bottom. Titanic is a classic example of it. Advocates of leaving the San Jose untouched for the moment say that unlike the corroding wreck of the Titanic, the Galleon is largely encased in mud, which keeps it in a state of relative equilibrium. But there is another reason to salvage the San Jose as soon as possible, says Daniel de Narvaez, the nautical historian. The idea of leaving shipwrecks in situ, he says, is very romantic. I love it. It's really nice. But it doesn't work when you have people that are starving. Once it's been found, who's not going to go there and see if I find a gold bar or an emerald or a ring or something? I won't be surprised if, as we speak, the San Jose is being plundered. I think there's probably a 50-50 chance that it's happening today. The Colombian Navy patrols the waters above the San Jose 24/7, but that wouldn't discourage a resourceful pirate equipped with a long-range ROV or a small submarine, presuming they know the coordinates. The Titanic lies more than 2 miles deep, almost 5 miles deeper than the San Jose. Yet thousands of its artifacts have been pillaged and sold on the black market since the wreck was discovered in 1985. Purist archaeologists say what makes the San Jose the holy grail of shipwrecks is not the gold and silver it carried, but its cultural significance to the people of Colombia. Yet undeniably, one of the main reasons it looms so large in the Colombian consciousness is its formidable treasure. That is what Commodore Weigers was after, what the Count of Casalegre gave his life to defend, and what fired Gabriel Garcia Marquez's imagination. Cossack believes archaeologists are not immune to Cortez's disease of the heart. They're a bunch of hypocrites, he said. The reality is what motivates everything is the gold and silver on board. While searching for the San Jose, he says, the team encountered another shipwreck, probably Spanish, probably just as old, but not likely to contain any treasure. Does anybody give a shit about that wreck?
Thank you.
Come Together by Joe Hagan. Legend has it that recording the album Let It Be was all misery and infighting, but Peter Jackson's new documentary, The Beatles Get Back, mines long-lost footage for a revelatory look at the band's last chapter. Opening photos in harmony. John Lennon, Ringo Starr, Paul McCartney, producer George Martin welcoming keyboardist Billy Preston, Lennon mugging for the camera, studio hijinks, George Harrison. Paul appears first, scanning the horizon as a gust of London wind tousles his dark hair. Then Ringo, in a red vinyl coat, ducking below scaffolding to examine his drum kit, cigarette dangling from his mouth. George, in black fur coat and lime green pants, straps on a Telecaster as John arrives to take in the weird scene through gold-framed spectacles. Amplifiers and mics, movie cameras and crewmen scurrying around the rooftop of a five-story building on a cold gray day. John rubs his hands to warm them as a young film director puffs a cigar and shares a word with Paul. Billy Preston tests the keys on his organ, and George fingers a familiar R&B riff. Yoko Ono, dressed entirely in black, looks on. An expectant bustle. A clapperboard snaps, and then it happens. One, two, three, four. In split screen, we see crowds gather on adjoining rooftops, like chimney sweeps from Oliver Twist. On the streets below, suited businessmen and young office workers crane their necks to the sky. "Where's the noise coming from?" ask an onlooker. "Get back, Jojo." It's the Beatles, as none would ever see or hear them again. Their last live performance as a group, January 30th, 1969. It's also the Beatles as none of us, 52 years on, has ever seen them. The approximately 43-minute sequence from director Peter Jackson's forthcoming film, The Beatles Get Back, screened exclusively for Vanity Fair, shows the full uninterrupted concert on the roof of 3 Savile Row, the band's headquarters, including iconic performances that would appear on their last album, Let It Be. The original footage, taken from at least 9 different cameras, has been scrubbed to astonishing clarity, detail, and color. A rapturous window in time. The movie was to debut on Disney Plus in November. For a Beatles fan, this is manna from heaven, every detail taking on immense power. Paul's brown shoe tapping in rhythm to George's guitar. John flubbing a line. George smiling at the F-up. Paul peering over to make sure John picks up the slack. An assistant crouching to hold a clipboard of newly written lyrics for Dig a Pony so John can remember them. Car horns blowing on the streets. As John belts out Danny Boy between songs. The beauty of Ringo's observant eyes behind the kit, and George's Mona Lisa smile as nerves settle and the band soars behind John in the transcendent chorus of Don't Let Me Down. We witness John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr locked together as a band in real time, and the alchemical mix of tough and tender, McCartney helming his Hofner bass like a bearded sea captain, Lennon's vulnerable smile peeking through long hair is freshly shocking. Movingly, none appear more surprised by the magic of the Beatles than the band themselves. Next photos. The band played on. Lennon during a rehearsal. Starr fiddling around on McCartney's bass. Yoko Ono sitting in on a session with the band. "We went to London and screened that to Apple," says Jackson, referring to the company founded by the Beatles in 1968, which still manages their legacy, and they were excited. Then Paul saw it, and Ringo saw it. And then the whole emphasis at that point became, let's have the entire concert in the film. Let's just show the whole thing. The whole thing, including a comic subplot involving a baffled 19-year-old policeman responding to noise complaints and getting a sly runaround from Apple staffers, forms the climax of Jackson's film, A 21-Day Diary of the Beatles in Their Intimate Creative World. Drawn from nearly 60 hours of archival footage, it depicts the band jamming, writing, arranging, clowning, sparring, riffing, struggling, and finally succeeding to make Let It Be. All this footage was originally shot for Michael Lindsay Hoag's Verite documentary Let It Be, which included a roughly 22-minute version of the rooftop concert, but became known by the few who saw it for very different reasons. The movie premiered in May 1970, a month after the Beatles broke up, and was largely regarded as depressing evidence of the band's dissolution, before promptly going out of circulation. In black market versions, the original 16mm film, converted to 35mm for the big screen, looked somber, saturated in blues and greens. A Beatles fanatic since the 1970s, he was 8 when they broke up, Jackson himself owned a fourth-generation bootleg on VHS, the muddy quality confirming his grim view of the period. Indeed, the director was the first skeptic of Apple's project to disinter the footage. "I actually didn't say yes," recalls the 3-time Oscar-winning director of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. "I said, can I look at all the footage first, and then I'll let you know. Because I was thinking I'd love to make a Beatles film, but I don't want to make the Beatles breakup film. That's the one Beatles movie I would never want to make." And so, after first meeting with Apple, Jackson returned to his home in New Zealand with the unedited footage from the movie, The Rushes in filmmaking argot, and sat down to see for himself. "I was waiting for it to go bad," he says, "and I had a kind of heavy heart." As he watched, says Jackson, history shifted. "What I found is that I was laughing continuously. I just was laughing. I was laughing and laughing and laughing, and I didn't stop." When Jackson went backstage at a Paul McCartney concert in Auckland, New Zealand, in 2017, he was surprised to find McCartney nervous to meet him, concerned with what Jackson had found in the footage. "I could see on his face he was imagining the worst," says the director. "I just said to him, 'Look, I've got to say, it surprised the hell out of me, because I was expecting it to be a miserable experience for you. I expected to have to witness a rather bleak moment, but it's actually the exact opposite. It's incredibly funny, it's incredibly lively, it shows you guys having a great time.'" "And he couldn't believe it," says Jackson. He said, "What? What? Really? Really?" And it certainly surprised him, because he has never seen this stuff, even though he lived through it. "It's a long time ago, and subsequent events, I think, just muddled the whole memory of this thing." Next, photo, open mic. McCartney, who pushed for the original Let It Be documentary. Last year, when Disney released a teaser for Get Back, meant to assuage expectant fans after the movie was delayed for a year because of COVID-19, the montage of never-seen footage showing Lennon gleefully horsing around the studio with McCartney, doing a comic version of Two of Us through clenched teeth, and Ono chatting warmly with McCartney's wife, Linda Eastman, looked revelatory, astonishing, and a bit suspicious to fans with even a passing knowledge of Beatles history. Was Jackson cherry-picking moments of levity to sell a revisionist history? A whitewash? "I don't think they'll feel that way when they've seen it," Jackson says, "but I understand where that's coming from. This is not what you read in the books." The books, of course, have long been in accord. The Let It Be sessions were a miserable time for the Beatles. an inflection point for their coming breakup, as Ono became a wedge between Lennon and the band, and Harrison yearned to break free from the mopped-up machine, even quitting the Beatles at one point. In the weeks after the recordings, Lennon recruited manager Alan Klein to take over the band's business affairs, and McCartney hired his own father-in-law, attorney Lee Eastman, to counter Klein's machinations, leading to a vicious legal battle that lasted long after the band dissolved. In the aftermath, Lennon savaged the Let It Be sessions, telling Rolling Stone they were writing about Yoko looking miserable in the Let It Be film. But you sit through 60 sessions with the most big-headed, uptight people on earth and see what it's effing like, and be insulted just because you love someone. And so went the story until 48 years later, when AppleCorp CEO Jeff Jones and Apple executive Jonathan Clyde invited Jackson to their offices in London to discuss a traveling Beatles exhibition that would feature unrelated archival films. They asked Jackson whether he could update old footage using the same technology he used to revive vintage World War I reels for the acclaimed 2018 documentary They Shall Not Grow Old. When Jackson casually asked about the Let It Be movie, he was told that a separate project to make a new film from the Rushes was in the works, but that the original director had just dropped out. At this, Jackson perked up. So I just put up my hand and I said, "Well, if you've just lost a filmmaker, I'm sitting here, I'll do it," he says. The Beatles exhibition never happened. But after Jackson reviewed the Let It Be footage twice, he realized he would be telling a much different story from the one most people understood. Unlike Ron Howard's 8 days a week, the touring years, the 2016 documentary about the mid-60s period, before the Beatles, overwhelmed by fan mania, stopped playing live, Jackson's film isn't just a delicious peek at lost footage, though it is that. It's an amendment to the received history. Though Get It Back is made for modern eyes decades after the events themselves, it's faithful to the intent of the original, which was to document the band's return to live performance after they ceased playing concerts in 1966. Director Michael Lindsay-Hogue, the son of Irish actor Geraldine Fitzgerald, was the 28-year-old director of British pop music TV show Ready, Steady, Go! When the Beatles asked him to produce a series of promotional movies for their 1968 singles. For a Hey Jude film, Lindsay-Hogue brought in a small audience, a mix of young people and regular folk, like a village postman, to sing along to what would become a legendary chorus. The experience revived the Beatles' desire to play in front of people, and McCartney hatched a plan to make a TV show with taped performances of new Beatles songs before a small audience. The show would include a montage of behind-the-scenes verite footage of rehearsals. "Paul was the driving force behind the whole project," says Lindsay-Hogue. And so, on the second day of January 1969, the Beatles showed up at the cavernous Twickenham Studios in London to begin rehearsing songs for a TV show that would also be the basis of a live album. They chose Twickenham because Starr was shooting a movie there, The Magic Christian, co-starring Peter Sellers. At Twickenham, the Beatles rehearsed Get Back, Two of Us, and The Long and Winding Road, among others. And then, on day 7, Harrison walked out following arguments with McCartney. "George quits," says Lindsay-Hogue. "Everything comes to a halt for a couple of days." And we're all sitting around and doing nothing much, and everyone's tetchy. Paul's tetchy. And then George will only come back if we go to Apple, the studio which they have in the basement. "That little episode," he continues, "has been taken and completely blown up by some people to represent acrimony between George and Paul and underlying severe tension. And in fact, It's just a small little cloud which passes over their working relationship in 5 minutes. That's all it was. But the conflict was a major pivot in the production. The TV show idea was scrapped, and instead, Beatles management decided to expand the project into a feature film to fulfill a 3-picture contract that manager Brian Epstein had forged with United Artists before he died in 1967. The first two films were A Hard Day's Night and Help. Bowing to Harrison's demand, the Beatles moved the sessions to their recording studio at Apple, and Lindsay Hogue and crew continued shooting for a documentary. For his own film, Jackson decided that when Harrison and McCartney begin fighting, a brief but tense scene in which McCartney placates a wounded Harrison after criticizing his guitar parts, he would show not only that, but the aftermath as well. Consequently, Jackson says, Get Back will be more revealing than the original, not less. It's a lot tougher movie than Let It Be, he says. I mean, Let It Be couldn't show George leaving the group, which he did on the 7th day, and then he obviously came back again. Let It Be never showed that. Jackson says he didn't need to manipulate Lindsay Hogue's original footage or include talking heads to contextualize things to create a dramatic film. The sessions formed their own story, and Get Back, he decided, could simply be a documentary about the documentary. If this was a fictional movie about a fictional band, having one of the band members walk out at the end of the first act, it'd be the ideal thing that you'd actually write into a script, says Jackson. So, weirdly enough, these guys are playing out of their real life. They were not playing it out as a movie or a script. That was the truth of their life. And yet, somehow, in terms of these 21 days, it kind of weirdly fits it. And then the triumphant third act, where, against all odds, they're up on the roof playing. Fantastic. Lindsay Hogue needed a live performance for the climax of his documentary, so he and the Beatles bandied about possibilities. One involved an amphitheater on the coast of Africa at sunrise, with people streaming in like nomads, arriving to the Holy Land. Another, encouraged by Lennon, imagined a concert on the deck of an ocean liner, full of fans at sea. Ultimately, given the logistics and Harrison's reluctance to play live again, Lindsay Hogue proposed they go up to the roof of Apple Records and play an impromptu lunchtime concert. The band tentatively agreed, and support beams were built under the roof to hold the weight of the gear. But even in the moments before it was to happen, the band nearly didn't do it. As Lindsay Hogue describes in his memoir, Luck and Circumstance, the Beatles idled in the stairwell as McCartney tried rousing his bandmates. The six of us stood there, stasis about to set in, momentum about to be fatally lost, ennui about to settle its cloud on our beings. But one voice had not been heard from. Eyes under lids looked to that person. Time froze. "Eff it," said John. "Let's do it." By the time Lindsay Hogue screened the first cut of the Let It Be movie for the band, the night Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, there were clear signs that the Beatles were fracturing. The day after the screening, an Apple executive called Lindsay Hogue to say there was perhaps too much Lennon and Ono footage in the movie. He said, "Well, let me put it this way. I've had 3 phone calls this morning," says Lindsay Hogue, "so I get the message that some of John and Yoko should come out." He recut the film, and it premiered in May 1970, by which time the Beatles had officially broken up. None of the band members showed up for the film's premiere in London, and history's judgment began to harden around Let It Be as a breakup documentary. When Lennon and Ono watched the final cut, with Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner and his wife Jane in a movie house in San Francisco, they both wept while watching the rooftop sequence. In the decades since, the Let It Be film was essentially buried. After their breakup and the years-long financial and legal battles, the Beatles rarely agreed on much, but they did seem to agree that the Let It Be film was too bleak and emotionally painful to revisit. A significant technical issue also hampered any revival. In 1971, says Jackson, an Apple employee who worked in the Savile Row studio stole 140 hours of the audio, which left only a mono version used for the final cut of the film. The stolen tapes contained hours of sound recorded when the cameras weren't rolling, meaning there was potentially even more revelatory evidence to be unearthed. They eventually got Interpol involved, says Jackson. In the late 90s or early 2000s, they did a sting operation in Amsterdam and recovered all of the tapes, apart from 40. There were about 560 quarter-inch tapes. There are still 40 missing, but we managed to find some of that sound through other sources. As Apple has released more archival material in recent years, the historical perspective of the Let It Be era has shifted. Mark Lewison, the foremost Beatles scholar in the world, spent a month listening to the nearly 98 hours of studio recordings the Beatles made in January 1969, and, like Jackson, was amazed by what he discovered, declaring, "It completely transformed my view on what that month had been." Far from a period of disintegration, says Jackson, these 3 weeks are about the most productive and constructive period in the Beatles' entire career. The tracks you hear on Let It Be were recorded during this 3-week period. The band also rehearsed 3/4 of the Abbey Road album, about half of Harrison's All Things Must Pass album, a half dozen songs that would later appear on McCartney's solo albums, and a couple that would show up on Lennon's. It was, Jackson marvels, the Beatles doing these. Last year, McCartney told the Sunday Times that seeing uncut footage from Get Back was a relief, precisely because it countered his lingering guilt over the breakup of the Beatles. "It was so reaffirming to me, because it proves that my main memory of the Beatles was the joy and the skill. I bought into the dark side of the Beatles breaking up and thought, oh God, I'm to blame. I knew I wasn't, but it's easy when the climate is that way to start blinking so, to start thinking so. But at the back of my mind, it was always this idea that it wasn't like that. But I didn't see proof." After talking to McCartney in New Zealand, Jackson went to Starr's home in Los Angeles to show him the footage on an iPad. He was laughing, I was laughing, and began corresponding with Olivia Harrison, George's widow, who threw her support behind the film despite the documentation of George's discontent. "She saw the rooftop concert about the same time as Paul did," says Jackson. "She's seen it about 7 or 8 times since. She's very supportive." But what of Ono? For decades, she was a vigilant and astute gatekeeper of Lennon's legacy, a powerful and opinionated voice among the four parties who control how Beatles music and history is curated and reissued. McCartney, in interviews, has tried to correct Ono's storyline that her late husband was the most important Beatle. "The true genius of the band. As he told me in 2015, once John got murdered, he became the martyr, the Buddy Holly, the James Dean character. Because of the atrocity it was, a revisionism started to go on, and Yoko certainly helped it. There's no denying that the first cracks in the Beatles' facade had already appeared by the time of the Let It Be sessions, and that both fans and the press saw Ono as the bete noire in the plot line. For Get Back, Jackson says Lennon's son, Sean, represented the Lennon estate and watched the rooftop sequence in London last year. Ono's current status is unclear, but Jackson says he isn't beholden to anyone's agenda and has had control over the final cut of the film. I have gotten no edicts, he says. I mean, nobody from Apple, none of the Beatles, have told me what to do, or none of them have said to me, don't show this, don't show that. I've been given no censorship instructions at all. I've been left completely alone. Next photos, long winding road. McCartney in the control room. Harrison, Starr taking a break. The Beatles' last concert ever on the roof of Apple headquarters. Jackson is cognizant of the delicacy of a project in which he second-guesses another filmmaker's creative decisions. He met with Lindsay Hoag in Los Angeles in 2020 to show how his technology could transform the footage. He showed me a comparison of my Let It Be's footage and his stuff, says Lindsay Hoag, including how McCartney's hair appeared as a single block of color in the original, and now you can see every single strand of hair. Lindsay Hoag defends his own film as more original and up than people remember. He also says that Apple asked for his goodwill toward Jackson's film, which he looks forward to seeing, and that he feels it's Apple's intention to possibly re-release Let It Be a few months after Jackson's Get Back comes out. Quentin Tarantino's movie theater in Los Angeles, the New Beverly Cinema, has expressed an interest in screening Let It Be if it is re-released, he says. As for Jackson, he's developed a deeper admiration for the original, in part because of the circumstances under which Lindsay Hoag labored, what with an increasingly acrimonious band hovering around him. The Beatles that I'm dealing with now are Beatles that can't remember January 69, Jackson says. I mean, they literally can't. Not really. And I don't blame them. In a decisive and crucial creative act, Jackson says he avoided repeating footage from the original film. Even familiar scenes would use alternative camera angles. One of our mantras is that Let It Be is one movie, and our movie is a different movie, he says, and we're trying not to repeat any footage, with one or two tiny exceptions where we can't do anything else. But we're trying to not step on Let It Be's toes, so that it is still a film that has a reason to exist, and our movie will be a supplement to it. 51 years plus after the group broke up, Jackson's film is probably the last revelatory document we're likely to see. That it also documents their last official album gives it bittersweet power. Fans and scholars will likely debate whether Get Back is a revision of history or a correction, but it's something everyone craves. More Beatles. Says Jackson, Paul said to me at one stage, look, this stuff's fantastic. Because at the end of the day, I'm a Beatles fan. Thank you. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.